This is Audible.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents A Life in Parts by Bryan Cranston. Read by the author.
For Kyle and Amy, we made it. A life worth salvaging. For Robin and Taylor, you made it a life worth living. One man in his time plays many parts. William Shakespeare, As You Like It. Walter White. She stopped coughing. Maybe she'd fallen back asleep. Then suddenly vomit flooded her mouth. She grasped at the sheets. She was choking. I instinctively reached to turn her over, but I stopped myself. Why should I save her? This little junkie, Jane, was threatening to blackmail me, expose my enterprise to the police, destroy everything I had worked for, and wipe out the financial life preserver I was trying to leave my family, the only legacy I could leave them. She gurgled, searching for a gasp of air. Her eyes rolled back in her head. I felt a stab of guilt. God damn it, she's just a girl. Do something. But if I stepped in now, wasn't I just delaying the inevitable? Don't they all, at some point, end up dead? And poor dumb comatose Jesse, my partner, lying beside her. She's the one who got him on this shit in the first place. She'd kill them both. Kill us all, if I stepped in now and played God. I told myself, just stay out of it. When he wakes, he'll discover this tragedy, this accident on his own. Yes, it's sad. All death is sad. But he'll get over it in time. He'll get past this like every other bad thing that has happened to us. That's what humans do. We heal. We move on. A few months from now, he'll barely remember her. He'll find another girlfriend. He'll be fine. Fuck it. We all have to move on. I'll just pretend I wasn't here. But I am here. And she's a human being. Oh, God, what have I become? And then, somehow, as she was fading, she wasn't herself anymore. I wasn't looking at Jane, or Jesse's girlfriend, or the actor Kristen Ritter. I was looking at Taylor. My daughter, my real daughter. I wasn't Walter White anymore. I was Bryan Cranston. And I was seeing my daughter die. From the moment she was born in 1993, a bit premature, shy of 7 pounds, impossibly beautiful, I felt an instant, radical, unconditional love that redefined love. And I had never allowed myself to imagine losing her. But now I was seeing it, clearly, vividly. She was slipping away from me. She was dying. That was not the plan. When I do the homework for such a delicate scene, I don't make a plan. My goal when I prepare isn't to plot out each action and reaction, but to think, what are the possible emotional levels my character could experience? I break the scene down into moments or beats. By doing that work ahead of time, I leave a number of possibilities available to me. I stay open to the moment, susceptible to whatever comes. The homework doesn't guarantee anything. With luck, it gives you a shot at something real. It was a real fear that gripped me, my worst fear, a fear I hadn't fully expected to come to terms with. And my reaction is there, forever, at the end of the scene. I gasp, and my hand moves to my mouth in horror. When the director, Colin Buxey, said, "Cut," I was weeping. Deep, racking sobs. I explained to the people on set what had happened, what I had seen. Michael Slovis, our cinematographer, embraced me, my castmates too. I remember in particular Anna Gunn, who played my wife Skylar. I hugged her. I must have held on for 5 minutes. Poor Anna. Anna knew. As an actor, she has a fragility at her core. And she often had a hard time shedding her character's emotions after shooting a difficult scene. That will happen in an actor's life, and it happened to me that day. It was the most harrowing scene I did on Breaking Bad, and really, ever. It may seem odd, it may seem even ghoulish, to stand in a room packed with people and lights and cameras and pretend I'm letting a girl choke to death. And then to see my daughter's face in lieu of that girl, and to call that work, to call that your job. But it's not odd to me. Actors are storytellers, and storytelling is the essential human art. It's how we understand who we are. I don't mean to make it sound high-flown. It's not. It's discipline and repetition and failure and perseverance and dumb luck and blind faith and devotion. It's showing up when you don't feel like it, when you're exhausted and you think you can't go on. Transcendent moments come when you've laid the groundwork and you're open to the moment. They happen when you do the work. In the end, it's all about the work. Every day on Breaking Bad, I'd wake up about 5:30 and get coffee, take a shower, and get dressed. Some days I was so tired, I didn't know whether I was coming or going. I'd drive the 9 miles from my condo in Knob Hill to Q Studios, 5 miles south of the airport in Albuquerque. ABQ, as the locals call it. I was in the makeup chair by 6:30. I'd shave my head anew, knock down the nubs. It didn't take too long for makeup. By 7 a.m., we'd see everyone, the other actors, the crew. Then we'd start rehearsing. The allotment was a 12-hour shoot, plus a 1-hour lunch. So a normal day was 13 hours. It was very rare that the day was shorter. Occasionally, it was longer. Some days went 17 hours. A lot of it had to do with whether we were on location. If it was just a minimum day, we'd wrap at 8 p.m. Then I'd grab a sandwich and an apple for the road. I didn't want to take time to stop. I'd call my wife Robin from the car. How are you? Yeah, long day. I'd see how she was doing. I'd ask about Taylor. I'd still be talking to her when I walked into the house. I'd say goodnight and then have that bite to eat while looking at what we were doing the next day. I'd take a hot bath with a little glass of red wine. Then I'd hit the sack. But even before the drive home, every night after wrap, I'd go in the hair and makeup trailer and take 2 hot, wet towels that my friends in the makeup department had pre-soaked. And I'd drape one over my head, and I'd wrap the other over my face. I'd sit there in the chair and let the makeup soak off, feeling all the toxins drain away. I'd sit until the towels went cold against my face, leeching myself of Walter White. That day I saw Jane die. That day I saw Taylor's face. That day I went to a place I'd never been. I opened my eyes and stared through the scrim of the white towel into the light above. I'd put everything into that scene. All the things I was and all the things I might have been. All the side roads and missteps. All the stuttering successes and losses I thought might sink me. I was murderous. And I was capable of great love. I was a victim, moored by my circumstances, and I was the danger. I was Walter White. But I was never more myself. Son. My parents met like most people do, in an acting class in Hollywood. My mother was born Annalisa Dorothea Sell, but she was always called Peggy. Peggy was an impulsive girl, fun-loving, a flirt. In her youth, she had a genuine innocence about her. She was one of those blonde, blue-eyed cuties, always told she ought to be in the movies. So after a 2-year stint in the Coast Guard and a failed starter marriage to a man named Easy, she left Chicago for Los Angeles, the land of empty promises, and flung herself into auditions and acting lessons. The litany of states where my dad, Joseph Lewis Cranston, grew up was so long I could never quite remember them all. Illinois, Texas, Florida, California, New York. As a kid, I imagined that he hailed from a family of grifters. Only outlaws could be so rootless. Being the new kids in school every few months, my dad and his brother Eddie were often picked on, so my grandfather taught them how to fight. Not street brawling, but the acceptable method, in the boxing ring. The Cranston boys had a gift. My father earned a boxing scholarship to the University of Miami. He fought up and down the East Coast. in and out of the ring. In all my early memories, my dad was fighting someone or something, and he could tell a story. The handsome pugilist and raconteur and the blue-eyed flirt fell for each other in a hot flash. It's easy to do that in an acting class. And after a couple years, they tied the knot at the little brown church in the valley on Coldwater Canyon Avenue in Studio City. My mother became a 50s wife. Everything she had, she threw behind her new husband and his goal to become a movie star. They bought a modest tract home and followed the script. My brother, Kim, came first in 1953, then me in 1956, and finally my sister Amy in 1962. We lived in Canoga Park in a single-story home at 8175 McNulty Avenue, close enough to Hollywood in physical distance, but a world away. The Valley may be best known for its lazy-tongued, sun-baked drawl. Seasons in the Valley were subtle. In the warm months, when the air pollution level was deemed dangerously high, our outdoor activities were restricted. We had smog days rather than snow days. We'd lie on our backs making smog angels in the yellow grass. Mom was an Avon lady, a volunteer at the Braille Institute for the Blind, a Tupperware representative, a team mom for our little league, and a member of the PTA. She handmade our Halloween costumes every year. Dad was our coach in Little League. He loved baseball, so I loved baseball. And I do to this day. I went to a Dodgers game with Dad when I was 4 or 5. The Dodgers had moved from Brooklyn to L.A., but they didn't yet have a stadium. So they played at the Los Angeles Memorial Coliseum for 4 seasons, from 1958 through 61. The Coliseum was built for football and track and field, so the dimensions were strange for baseball. An enormous right field and a shallow left field, like Fenway Park in Boston. They put a high screen over the left field fence in the Coliseum. To get a home run, a batter had to clear the screen. Even though left field was short, that screen was dauntingly high, 42 feet. Fenway's world-famous green monster is 37. A player named Wally Moon, who hailed from the cotton fields of Arkansas, developed a knack for hitting home runs over that net. He'd switch his swing to an uppercut and whack it so high you thought he might punch a blue hole in the smoggy cloud wall. Home run! People took to calling those soaring hits moonshots. I'd watch the ball hang in the sky, a pop-up, really, for a moment of breathless suspense, and then elation, glory. That captured my imagination. Swinging for the impossible. Shooting for the moon. Even after the Dodgers moved to their permanent home at Chavez Ravine in 1962, and even after things at my house started to fall apart, I knew I could depend on the smell of fresh-cut grass, Vin Scully's dulcet voice calling the game on the radio, and the clean symmetry of the baseball diamond, the sense of hope you could dare to have with runners at the corners and no outs. My dad would take us to the movie and TV sets where he worked as an actor. Once, he surprised us with something inside a trailer hitched to our car. He opened it up and we peered into a dark, dung-scented metal box. A donkey. My father let it roam around our backyard for a time. I remember that donkey so well. His name was Tom. All the boys and girls in the neighborhood came over to admire him and to go for a ride. We had him for a little while, maybe a month or two, and then he went back to wherever he belonged. Bye, Tom. Nice knowing you. My dad brought home props for my brother and me, infantry helmets and badges and uniforms. Later, I realized he must have borrowed them and then returned them the following week. Props on a set are tracked carefully. They're not toys, but for us, they were a great treat. When my dad brought prop guns home, we loved to play war. All the boys in the neighborhood were always battling the Germans or the Japanese or the American Indians. We didn't really understand history or war or why these people were our enemies. That's just the way things were. And then one day, an announcer came on TV and said, "We interrupt this program to bring you a special report." Every time I heard that for years to come, I clinched. And then Walter Cronkite was on the screen, somber. "From Dallas, Texas, The flash apparently official. President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time. I remember how he took off his glasses. He wasn't a stoical journalist anymore. The mask came off. He was just a man, overcome by the size and shock of the loss. There was a gasp, and then a panic. My mother was weeping and clutching herself. And then she was locked in on the phone, as if my brother and I had disappeared. The adults couldn't get enough news. My dad came home, solemn, and the neighbors stopped by. The phone rang nonstop. They needed to tell each other that it was going to be okay. I don't know how much I understood, but I felt the gravity of it. And now we had a new president, Lyndon Johnson. He talked funny. I don't know that I'd ever heard that deep of a Texas drawl, and I thought his wife had a strange name. Our parents were devastated. We were learning life and death, and fear and grief, and succession. We didn't know what to do. A neighborhood kid declared, "We are not playing with guns anymore." We loved guns, but we tossed them aside, imagining that we could somehow alter the course of things with our gesture. It didn't last long. The urgency diminished, and normal life resumed. But it was a new normal. The Outlaw Frank James. Whereas I was a goof as a kid, my brother Kim had a serious streak. He was introspective. He was smarter than me, not quite as athletic, but we were aligned in almost every other way, brothers in every sense, and we both inherited the acting gene. Kim became my first director. He wrote and mounted the McNulty Avenue Garage production of The Legend of Frank and Jesse James, then cast me as Frank James. For Jesse, he looked next door to the Burrell household. The Burrells had five boys, and my brother chose Howard, the middle boy, to play the heartless outlaw. Kim cast himself as the sheriff, several victims, townspeople, the coroner, and a newspaperman. I'm not sure why he didn't cast others. There were plenty of kids in the neighborhood. Maybe he wanted them to pay their nickel like everyone else. We draped white sheets over storage boxes, and they became snow-capped mountains. We fashioned a blue plastic tarp into a raging river. A stuffed alligator snapped at our heels. Alligators abounded in the Old West. Of course, the denouement was a fateful shootout. We were boys pretending to kill each other, playing with glee and abandon. My first venture as a professional actor was a family production, too. My dad wrote, directed, and produced a series of ads for the United Crusade, which would later change its name to the United Way. I guess invoking a blood-soaked religious war wasn't the vibe they were going for as a charity. My dad cast me as the lead. I was 7. The story went, I was playing baseball with friends on a sandlot when a foul ball rolled into the street and I gave chase. "Look out!" I got hit by a car, put into an ambulance, rushed to the ER, and put into a head-to-toe body cast. Weeks later, the cast came off, and I started physical therapy on the parallel bars and in the pool to learn how to walk again. In the last scene, I held hands with a woman pretending to be my mother as we joyfully walked out of the hospital, healed. I was 7. I remember shooting every one of those scenes. I remember feeling that there was something special about what I was doing. Maybe it was just the attention, but I think it was something more, a sense that I was part of something greater than myself. Son. I especially loved acting for my dad. He was a big man in my eyes, barrel-chested with striking black hair that gave way to distinguished salt and pepper before he turned 40. He always seemed so tall to me, but as he aged, I realized that he was just shy of 5'9" at his high water mark. He was never that tall. My dad wanted to be a star. No doubt, no compromise, nothing else would do. He wanted the home run. But there were bills to pay. When he wasn't working as an actor, my dad wrote scripts and did some directing and dabbled in businesses. Over his lifetime, there were a lot of businesses. He started a company that offered a video assist to help golfers perfect their swing. He opened a recreational trampoline center and then a bar and coffee shop. He had plans for a catamaran cargo ship company. He ran a magazine for Hollywood tourists called Stars Homes. At one point, he operated a tour of Liberace's Gilded House. The man didn't lack for ideas. He approached each venture with vigor, but seldom found success. He had more ambitions and brain children than business acumen. His failures mounted and ate at him. And yet he never gave up. That was instructive. He kept at it. His was the typical actor's life. Uncertain employment. A little kismet. Lots of hard luck. As a child, I never really felt the difference when the family was flush or flat broke. But my parents sure did. We got a brand new car one year. A while later, we sold it and got an old car. A little elbow grease and it's just like new. Another year, my parents, really my dad, decided to go to the great expense of installing a built-in swimming pool in the backyard. Everyone in the neighborhood came to our house that summer, and we laughed and swam until our fingers were shriveled and our bloodshot eyes cried uncle. And then we beached ourselves, belly down, on the warm concrete and recovered. The following summer, my mother told us that we wouldn't be able to swim because we couldn't afford the chemicals. As a result, our pool turned murky green, like a pond somewhere in the deep woods. My dad did have some moderate success as an actor. He was featured in several TV shows, a handful of films. He co-wrote the script for The Crawling Hand, a movie about an astronaut whose dead hand goes on a rampage targeting beach-going teenagers. He also co-wrote The Corpse Grinders, a trash flick that was part of a triple feature, which also included The Embalmers and The Undertaker and his grisly pals, still fondly recalled by drive-in purists. He acted in an incredibly fake and delightfully cheesy movie called Beginning of the End, a low-budget sci-fi film made in the late 50s by the great Burt I. Gordon, a.k.a. Mr. Big, who specialized in giant movies that he made by superimposing images onto his films. For this one, Gordon filmed real grasshoppers, then unconvincingly superimposed them onto the action. You know the classic story. An invasion of angry, voraciously hungry, giant, man-eating grasshoppers created at an experimental farm in Illinois. Joe Cranston played a soldier stationed as a lookout on the top of a skyscraper. Grasshoppers were attacking the city, don't they always? You never see them descending on a field of wheat. When my dad reports to his superiors over the two-way radio, he is still peering through his binoculars. "Eastern sector clear," he says. Just then, the quivering antennae of a giant grasshopper appear behind him. Cut back to headquarters. The officers are listening to Dad's report, his voice emanating through the speaker on the wall. "No sign of them here." Then, a blood-curdling scream. "No!" Dad was a goner. Great stuff. If my dad was featured in a show or movie on TV, neighbors would drop by the next day to report how they felt about his work. "I liked the production value, but all the actors were turkeys. The beginning was great, but the end was a fiasco." That was my first brush with celebrity and critics. There was always a but. Everyone felt entitled to voice his or her opinion. As an actor, you were fair game. My dad didn't seem to lack for confidence, and yet the endless stream of buts got to him. When things went south, he spewed and fumed resentment towards others he felt were unworthy of their success. "He was better than that actor. He worked harder than this other guy." So much of the world made him mad. You never knew what was going to set him off. I remember riding in the front seat of my dad's car with my brother late one afternoon, and a guy driving a hot rod cut him off. Dad slammed on the brakes and straight-armed my brother and me to keep us from flying through the window. We were in the rusted car that had replaced our new one. My dad gave chase, honking, and at a stoplight he pulled up alongside the spiffy car and rolled down his window and started yelling. The man said, "What are you going to do about it, old man?" My dad's gray hair belied his vigor, and this guy was young, much younger than my dad. "Pull around the corner," my dad said, "and I'll show you what I'm going to do about it." They turned the corner and parked behind some stores. Stay here, my dad instructed my brother and me. We were terrified, clutching each other. My dad got out of the car. The other man got out of his car. He was tall and well-built, much taller than my dad. But my dad marched right over to him and punched him in the face. The guy hit his car and fell to the ground, his nose a bloody mess. My dad came back to the car, got in, and drove off. Don't mention this to your mother. It'll only make her worry. Kim and I twisted around to peer out the rear window as we drove away. The man was holding his face. His face was covered in blood. My father had done that. That was my father, the fighter. The violence wasn't reserved to random motorists. My father and my mother fought too, careening, blistering fights that occasionally left us children cowering in our rooms out of the line of fire. Things were already shaky by the time my dad took over the lease of the Corbin Bowl, a bar and coffee shop attached to a bowling alley on Ventura Boulevard in Tarzana. The occasional appearances on TV weren't enough to sustain a family, and anyway, he had a vision for the bar, something cool and sophisticated with nightclub singers. The coffee shop would bustle during the daytime, while the club ruled the night. It didn't turn out like that. My grandmother manned the cash register. My mother worked as a fry cook and waitress. Kim and I bussed tables and washed dishes after school. Even my 5-year-old sister did her part, bringing water to the tables. My dad managed the bar, but he was often away. Maybe at an audition, maybe at a clandestine rendezvous. My brother and I were aware of the fragility of the situation, if not the fine details. We waited in knotted anxiety for our dad's reappearances and the inevitable fights that ensued. We looked for a respite wherever we could get it. The movies were our favorite escape. We went to the coffee shop nearly every day after school, and at 3 p.m., if we had done our homework, we went next door to the Corbin Theater to catch an afternoon screening before we had to be back at the coffee shop to help with the evening business. Our favorite flick was Cat Ballou, a Western spoof about a prim schoolmarm who sets out to avenge the death of her father and becomes a notorious outlaw. Lee Marvin had two roles, the legendary gunfighter Kid Chalene and gunslinger Tim Strawn. It tickled us to recognize the same actor in two roles. Nat King Cole and Stubby Kaye played a kind of a Greek chorus and crooned The Ballad of Cat Ballou. My brother and I both had wild crushes on Jane Fonda. She was tough and beautiful. We went to see that movie every day as long as it played. We knew every word, every microfacial expression, every gesture. We'd go home and take a bath, and before bed, we'd act out the scenes, playing different characters, singing at the top of our lungs, Cat Ballou, Cat Ballou, she's mean and evil through and through. Over 2 years, we saw all kinds of movies at the Corbin. The Glass Bottom Boat, Oh Dad, Poor Dad, Mama's Hung You in the Closet and I'm Feeling So Sad, The Graduate. I was 11, too young for The Graduate, but I loved it. I related to Dustin Hoffman's character, his confusion. He was trying to figure things out. That's how I felt, too. I was just starting puberty, just starting to awaken to the allure of girls. And I was enchanted and nervously excited by the idea that an older woman could seduce you, would want to seduce you. Dustin Hoffman's character watching in awe as Anne Bancroft pulls her stockings onto her beautiful legs. The taboo image stayed with me wherever I went. Until that movie, I thought there was some kind of law that you had to be with someone your own age for the parts to fit. Corbin Bowl was a dud. My dad had to bow out after a couple of years. He was devastated. My parents grew even further apart. After that, there was a period of weaning off. He started to show up at home less and less, and then not at all. 2 years later, we went to a courthouse with my mom. She wore her best dress and a lot of makeup. Despite her coiffure and pretty facade, her mood was tense and downbeat. I think she told us she was the witness to someone's divorce. I don't remember exactly when we learned it was hers, sometime later. We saw my father in the cold marble courthouse hallway under the fluorescent lights. We hadn't seen him in 2 years. I remember his dress shoes, and then his face close to ours when he knelt down to say hello. And then moments later, in a blur of violence, he slugged a guy. Boom! Man down, blood splattered. Jimmy! Jimmy! It turned out Jimmy was the husband of the woman my dad stole and would soon marry. Her name was Cindy. It all happened so quickly. Maybe it took 2 minutes. 2 minutes. And then my dad was gone. I wouldn't see him again for a decade. Flea Marketeer. I remember lying to my friends and neighbors, the Burrell boys, when they asked me, "Where's your dad?" "Oh, he's been working every day, but he comes home at night and he wakes us up and we play for a long time." I think they believed it. Even I started to believe it. For a while, my dad had been a ghost, and then he was gone. We were never told why. In fact, we were never told anything. That's just what happened. Move on. For the longest time, I thought my sister Amy, who was too young to understand what was happening, was luckier for sliding through that period relatively unscathed. But now, I realize that she missed all the happiness and stability of the time before things fell apart. The Christmas lights, the outings, and the games we play as a family. Because we had known the good times, I think my brother and I felt the loss more acutely. My father's waning presence, his chronic absence, his disappearance. Now he was just a memory. My dad had been the love of my mom's life. In his wake, she was devastated, angry. She began tending to her resentment like a private garden that was more real to her than any living thing. Where once she was vibrant and accessible, now she was overtaken by depression and inertia. She was once caring and present. Now she was sullen and melancholy and remote. She began to drink, slowly at first, and then not slowly. She started with wine, boxed wine, wine in jugs with a little finger hole. I saw a lot of those empty jugs. She would perch at the kitchen table, draining her glass, and complain to my brother and me, "Your father, your father. He needed to be a star, and he wasn't a star, and that's what drove him crazy." She sometimes turned to me and say, with a sneer of bitterness and pain, "You look just like him." What was she going to do? Since there was now zero money coming in, she needed to find a pathway to income. Mom was a natural pack rat, so the obvious avenue was to sell off some assets. Her plan was to pack up her 56 pink Cadillac, probably a holdover from one of our up periods, and take it to the Simi Valley swap meet to sell whatever she could. Every Saturday night, Kim and I would pack the Pink Lady, as my mom had affectionately dubbed her car, to the roof. And every Sunday morning before sunrise, we'd somehow, some way, stuff ourselves in, too, for the 25-mile trip to the Simi Valley Drive-In Theater. Kim and I were charged with unloading the car and arranging the eclectic items for sale on blankets. We made tidy rows while Mom went scouring for bargains from other sellers. About the time we finished setting up our wares, Mom would return with armloads of other people's junk for us. Not for us, exactly, not for our personal use, but to resell at a profit. We carefully integrated the new haul into our own. When Mom found out there was another swap meet opening up on Saturdays in the community of Saugus in Santa Clarita, we added that to our itinerary. We now spent the whole weekend at swap meets. We were in the junk business. Once we sold off our own items, we became fully dedicated to hawking other people's goods. The garage that Kim and I once used as a stage for creative expression was now creating an expression all its own. Junk filled the space from floor to ceiling. It wasn't just the garage. The house was now unrecognizable to us. Everything was stacked and crowded and askew. Slightly used bedding and secondhand clothing and radios with broken speakers and ratty furniture and tarnished table settings. There were dolls with one eye missing, and tattered magazines with their covers torn off. I came to abhor clutter. I still feel uneasy when things around me are in disarray. But Mom pressed on. In spite of her growing desperation and despair, there was something valiant about her tenacity. I think she really did believe the swap meets would save us. But in the end, the numbers wouldn't add up. After a while, the bank told her that we were going to lose the house. And then we did. Professor Flipnoodle. I got adequate grades, but the teacher comment section of my report card was always filled with ominous statements. Brian needs to apply himself. Brian is often goofing around and disruptive. Brian spends too much time daydreaming. I so clearly remember hearing these comments reworked and recited back to me as admonishments whenever my parents disapproved of my behavior. If I were a kid today, I'd probably be diagnosed with mild ADHD. Back then, the only descriptor for my condition was, Brian needs to pay more attention. So now, entering the fifth grade, what was different? Maybe I looked to school as a respite from the chaos at home. Maybe school was a safe place where I could focus my energies. Whichever. My grades rose, and so did my spirits. Suddenly I was popular. I was invited to parties and asked to run for student body president. I was a good athlete, not great, just good. But I harbored the dream that one day I would become a Major League Baseball player. I also dreamed of Carolyn Kiesel, a torturously cute classmate. She wore her dark brown hair in an adorable cut that framed her petite features. Rather than telling this sweet girl how I felt or striking up a conversation, I put some of the tasty paste we used for arts and crafts in her hair. Naturally, that made Carolyn angry with me, which was all right by me. I understood anger. It was affection I couldn't wrap my head around. Having Carolyn yell at me was at least better than having her not notice me at all. Eventually, I realized that I needed another way to tell Carolyn I liked her. Maybe next year, when we were both mature sixth graders. I was very fortunate to have two wonderful mentors in Mrs. Waldo and Mrs. Crawford, my fifth and sixth grade teachers at Sunny Bray Elementary. Neither of them was finger-wagging or textbook. They wanted their students to find their own way to express themselves, and they encouraged me to explore performance. I learned that there were other ways to do a book report besides sitting down and writing the tired old Huck Finn, Mark Twain's most acclaimed work, tells the story of the travails of a young man as he leaves his hometown seeking adventure, blah, 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 blah. None of that. I could act it. I could be Huck Finn. Or Professor Flipnoodle. Professor Flipnoodle was the lead role in our school play, The Time Machine. Flipnoodle was the machine's wacky inventor, who traveled back in time to seminal, teachable moments in history. 2 years earlier, the school had done the same play with my brother in the lead role, and I was blown away by his ability. When Kim donned the character's fire-red curly wig on the stage, he became a different person. I remember sitting in that audience and knowing with piercing clarity that I wanted to wear that wig too. At last, my audition arrived. I can't remember the details, but I must have been good. I got the role. The wig was mine. Two performances were scheduled, one in the daytime for the student body and teachers, and one at night for the parents. I chipped away at the text and memorized it. I was confident that everything would fall into place. Doing a play was like an oral book report, just longer. With the red curly wig as my talisman, I breezed through the afternoon performance, winning applause and cheers. During a break, a castmate and friend, Jeff Widener, a convincing Davy Crockett, shared an idea, a note he thought would be a funny addition to the evening performance. Hey, Brian, wouldn't it be funny if instead of saying, after delivering the Gettysburg Address, President Lincoln will return to the White House, you said, President Lincoln will return to the White Front. Wouldn't that be funny? In the 60s and 70s, a department store chain named the White Front was as ubiquitous in Southern California as Target is today. I laughed and agreed, sure, substituting White Front for White House would be funny. But saying that would ruin the play. My response was emphatic, serious. No. Conversation over. But now I was paranoid. I couldn't have been aware of the term mantra, and yet that's what I employed. I hammered these words into my head with grim determination. Don't say White Front. Don't say White Front. Hours later, I got up on that stage and performed my heart out. This happened before my dad punched the guy in the courthouse, but I don't remember him being in the auditorium. I knew my mother and brother and grandparents were out in the darkness, however, so I was filled with pride and adrenaline. I came to the part of the show dealing with the strife of the Civil War, and in a tone of supreme authority, I pronounced that, after delivering the Gettysburg Address, President Lincoln will return to the White Front. Silence. I realized what I had done instantly and stopped. Did they hear it? Maybe they didn't. Maybe God stepped in and corrected my word at the last second and saved me. I sheltered in the brief moment of silence and hope. But then came the laughter. The sound ricocheted off the walls and ceiling tiles like bullets. Men were doubled over in hysterics. Kids on stage were so overcome that snot was coming from their noses. Carolyn Kiesel was on stage too, crying with laughter, which extinguished any hope of currying favor with her for my afternoon's perfect performance. Everything came to a standstill, except my breathing. I stood there panting. I felt numbness in my face. A few years before, I had some teeth pulled, and afterward, as the drugs wore off, the world trailed by me in slow motion. Speech was distorted, faces misshapen. On stage at that moment, I was reliving that sensation, plus panic. I messed up something bad, real bad. I looked backstage, and there was my beloved Mrs. Waldo. She couldn't contain herself either. She was laughing so hard that she could barely muster the strength to wave her hand in a circle. She was signaling me to continue the play. But I couldn't. I was frozen. I suppose it lasted only a couple seconds, though it felt like an hour. Eventually, the roar quieted down to some softer laughter and tittering, and I sensed I could continue. But what to do next? Plow forward? Go back and correct the mistake? I decided on a do-over. I said the line again, as written. After delivering the Gettysburg Address, President Lincoln will return to the White House. Suddenly the room was loud again, with laughter. It was almost violent. The line now had a history, like a favorite joke. All you had to do was allude to it, and people started to lose control. I was no longer stunned. I was angry. I said it correctly! I couldn't understand why the audience wanted to continue to punish me. It felt mean. The meanness of it struck me to the core. I thought about walking off the stage, but somehow I knew that that would make things even worse. Eventually, the room settled down enough to start again. Fool me once. This time, I plucked out a line that came after the now charged, loaded words, White House. I pushed through the play with a hasty but precise pace, imagining everyone anticipating my next mistake so they could have another good chuckle at my expense. Finally, mercifully, it was over. I was upset. I was inconsolable. The worst part was that I had to endure the throngs backstage, thanking me for an evening they would not soon forget. That night set me on a course for many years to come. I became introverted, unsure of myself, and the one thing I knew for certain, performing was not for me. Suitor. Simon and Garfunkel's Mrs. Robinson was trilling from the record player, and Carolyn Kiesel was just a few feet away, looking beyond pretty. Perfect. She warmed up to me over the last year. Perhaps she'd even forgotten my flip noodle debacle. I'd stopped putting paste in her hair and learned to talk to her like a real person, and she responded. She was sweet and generous at an age when nerves and hormones often overruled those qualities. I thought maybe she even liked me. So I'd made a plan. I fingered the St. Christopher medal in my pocket. St. Christopher was the patron saint of travelers and mariners, and many surfers strung the medals around their necks for protection against the rough seas. For us in Southern California, the medal was a symbol of a man and his desires. Back then, you gave it to a girl when she agreed to go steady with you, and she wore it as a pendant. Mine was going to Carolyn. It was a leap. I felt something between us, but what if I was wrong? My dad was a ghost. The white front night shone like a specter behind me. I was quiet and unremarkable and shy. Why would she want me? I hesitated. I debated. I tried to summon my courage and confidence. As I hovered over a bowl of chips in agonizing conversation with myself, I only semi-understood what was happening as the new kid in school, a skateboard dude with blonde wavy hair, ambled up to Carolyn. "Where have you gone, Joe DiMaggio? A nation turns its lonely eyes to you. Woo, woo, woo." Suddenly, skateboard dude asked Carolyn if she wanted to go steady. She smiled. She said yes. Their faces moved together and they kissed. They kissed. They kissed right before my eyes, just a few feet away from me. Hey, hey, hey. They kissed as if I weren't there. Farmhand. Most people in a divorce situation are forced to sell their homes in order to tabulate assets and divvy them up. We didn't have that problem. The bank took our house. Banks do that when people stop paying their mortgages. They came and put a large sticker outlined in bright red on our front door, a proclamation to our friends and neighbors, our community, a scarlet letter. I saw the looks on our neighbors' faces, somehow both judgmental and pitying. We were disgraced. Worse, we were forced to leave what comforts remained of our home. I had been under the impression all this time that we owned our house. I came to understand that the word own is often used loosely. Amy and our mother went to stay at the home of our paternal grandmother. My mother was still in love with my dad, so by moving in with his mother, she thought she'd have a better chance of seeing him and perhaps even winning him back. Meanwhile, one week into the school year, Kim and I were yanked out of John Sutter Junior High and shipped off to live with our maternal grandparents, Otto and Augusta Sell, both immigrants from Germany. Otto was a baker by trade, but now in retirement he had a small parcel of land where he farmed and raised some scant livestock. They lived in Yucaipa, California, in the foothills of the San Bernardino Mountains, a quaint little rural town, but to us it was the boondocks. My grandparents' one-bedroom home was located right around the 3,000-foot elevation level. Snow dusted the town several times a year. The lone attraction in the area was farther up the road at Oak Glen Apple Orchards. Day trippers would find a petting zoo, a kitty amusement park, and the big draw, homemade apple pies, strudel, fritters, sauce, pretty much anything made from apples. Yucaipa was ideal for my grandfather, less so for my grandmother, but it was the 60s, and they were old world. The wife did as the husband pleased. Neither could have been pleased to take on the role of surrogate parents to two boys in turmoil. We were kids from the suburbs of Los Angeles. We bellyached. What were we going to do on a little farm? The answer came quickly. Work. Every day, except Sunday, we were expected to contribute sweat equity in exchange for room and board. Our new next-door neighbor, Danny Teeter, had an egg ranch, a few acres of chickens cramped in small cages. Our day started there. We soon learned that setting a clock wasn't necessary due to the cacophony of cock-a-doodle-doos at dawn. Until that time, chicken shit meant someone who was scared to lie down in the street and let kids jump their bikes over him with a homemade plywood ramp. But now it had a whole new repulsively toxic meaning. A vividly pungent smell that haunted my clothes and hair hours after I left the coop. "Breathe through your mouth, Brian." I did that for a while, but then some kid at school told me that when you smell poop, actual tiny particles of that poop are getting into your nose. If that were true, my mouth-breathing solution to the chicken shit problem meant I was actually eating poop. I went back to nose-breathing. Apart from being neck-deep in chicken shit, Danny was a good guy. He had Kim and me sell flats of eggs on weekends to day trippers as they journeyed up the hill to the apple orchard. But the job Kim and I loved most was egg collection. Nearly every day after school and after homework, Kim and I would hop the fence to Danny's property and eagerly go to work. We drove flatbed Cushman electric carts up and down the aisles of the coops, 200 feet long and just wide enough to accommodate the cart. Three chickens were housed in a 12-inch by 16-inch cage. The cage's floor was built with a slight incline, so that when a chicken pushed out an egg, it would gently roll toward the front of the cage and come to a rest against a curved stop. Kim and I collected eggs from both sides of the aisle and deposited them into flats on the front of the electric carts. A flat held 30. We were taught to stack them about 8 flats high. The cart held about 6 stacks. A lot of eggs. When we reached our limit, we'd drive to the cool, temperature-controlled egg room to unload. From there, each individual egg went through a washer. We thought of it as a mini car wash. The machine took the egg on a conveyor belt ride through pressurized cool water. No hot or warm water. You didn't want to promote the process of decay. And then soft bristles scrubbed the fecal matter and urine off the shell. One of us would place the eggs onto the conveyor, while the other watched everyone pass by a high-watt light bulb, looking through the gossamer shell for blood spots, which indicated a fertilized egg. People don't like to see blood spots in their frying pans when they make a Western omelet in the morning. Go figure. Each fertile egg was taken out of the washer and placed in a flat under a warming lamp. Soon it would be transferred to the hatchery to help regenerate the coop with new chicks. Once all the unacceptable eggs had been removed, there were some truly amazing freaks of the egg world. The remaining inventory was separated by size and placed in a cardboard container. Finally, we'd fill padded shipping boxes with the delicate cargo and place them in a large walk-in cooler. Twice a week, at 5 in the morning, we'd awaken to the combustible rattle of a diesel engine truck arriving to pick up our eggs and take them to market. That sound gave me such a sense of satisfaction. Work I had done was of value to the world. People would be fed by my hand. Grandpa Otto was a good neighbor, unfailingly friendly, and helpful to those in need. To thank him, and as a bonus for our labor, Danny gave him chickens, whose best laying days were behind them. Grandpa took them with delight. We'd monitor the hens to see which still had it in them to lay with some consistency. The old, the feeble, the infertile, they weren't so lucky. There is a correct way to kill a chicken. Otto taught us. Grab it by the legs with one hand, collapse the wings with the other, then secure the legs and wings with one firm hand. Next, lay the chicken on a block of a tree stump. Don't let go. Pick up the hatchet with your free hand. With one clean, strong stroke, drop the blade onto its neck. The head will fall to the ground, and the hatchet will be wedged into the block. Let go. Hold the chicken's body with both hands over a blood bucket until a couple of pints of warm blood has drained away. The chicken doesn't know it's dead just yet. The central nervous system will respond to the sudden loss of a brain with jerking and shaking. Steady. Once the blood is drained, toss the carcass into the dead chicken tub. Grandpa had already killed several chickens that day with a deftness and a stoicism that left us in silent awe. This is how it's done, boys. Neither Kim nor I wanted anything to do with murdering chickens. But we knew we were going to be expected to pull our weight. We stood there, impassive but steeped in dread. We had no choice. We had to absorb Grandpa's lessons and do the deed ourselves. Thank God Kim was older, so he was up first. It never crossed my mind to call him out for being nervous. I knew I was next. Kim grabbed his chicken correctly, let out a short, terrified breath, closed his eyes, and swung the hatchet. Instead of landing on the chicken's neck, he hacked right into the comb. A chicken's comb is like human hair. Getting it severed feels like getting a haircut. This was one rough haircut. Kim let go of the chicken in shock, but its comb was still fastened to the chopping block by the hatchet. The animal knew this wasn't just another day of pecking seed. It flapped and clucked, and sent its feathers flying in distress.
"Oh, for crying out loud,"
Otto said, and pushed Kim out of the way, grabbed the animal, pulled the hatchet out of the comb, and decapitated the chicken with one chop. He drained its blood and tossed it into the tub of other dead chickens. Easy peasy. Kim balled his fists and willed himself to do it again and do it right. He succeeded, a few times. Kim had proven himself. Now it was my turn. I filled my lungs with air that I hoped also contained minute particles of courage along with the chicken poop. I understood that this was some kind of test. If I passed, I would be welcomed into manhood. I used to pity our friends and neighbors, the Burrell boys, having to endure the rigors of memorizing passages from the Torah in preparation for their bar mitzvahs. Now I envied them. Reciting Hebrew was a cakewalk in comparison to this rite. I aggressively reached down and grabbed my first victim. The bird squawked, but I paid no attention to its discomfort. I was too concerned with my own. I remember saying a silent "I'm sorry" to the creature. I was its executioner, dead hen walking. I hooked my left hand around one of the chicken's spurs, the sharp, underdeveloped opposing digit that comes out of the back of the ankle. It dug into the flesh of my hand. I wasn't going to let that slow me down. I quickly gathered the wings and legs in one hand. I yanked the hatchet out of the stump with my free hand and plopped the chicken's head in its place. I was focused. No way was I going to wince and shut my eyes and miss my target as Kim had on his first attempt. No way. The chicken struggled to free itself from my grasp. Not a chance. I raised the hatchet well above my head and brought it down with a ferocious swing. The head plopped lifelessly to the ground. Clean. Dead. I'd done it. And I'd buried the blade deep into the chopping block. No time to revel in the glory. Once the head was off, the animal's central nervous system sent out emergency signals, and the carcass convulsed. I held steady, watching the dark red stream of blood drain into the nearly full blood bucket. But the violence of the shaking surprised me, and soon one of the wings was loose from my grasp. As I struggled to get the wing under control, the other one worked free. Blood was still flowing. I wasn't about to let it drip outside of the bucket and catch a furious "What the hell?" from my grandfather. I pressed the bird downward. Not a drop of blood hit the ground, but its wings flapped mightily, plunging deep into the bucket, sending streams of blood upward. Suddenly, blood was in my nostrils, ears, and mouth. Oh, God, I wore it. I tasted it. I drank it. But I didn't let go. By God, I should have, but I didn't. I had blood in my eyes, so I couldn't see. I tossed the carcass in the direction of the bucket where its brethren lay. I missed. The moment it hit the ground, the bloody, headless creature rose to its feet and ran around the yard, ricocheting against whatever obstacle it encountered. I tried to wipe off my bloody face, but there was blood on my hands. Kim later told me he stood in awe, switching his gaze from me to the chicken to me, one bloody mess to another. The chicken finally collapsed, and I hung my head while Kim rinsed me off with a garden hose. No way Grandpa was going to let me use the only indoor bathroom to clean up. That was reserved for Grandma. Kim and I were relegated to the outhouse. Grandpa even tried to teach us how to separate our waste for fertilizer. Good times. Later that night, I had to relive the Blood Boy experience as Grandpa, now finding the event very amusing, told the tale, with some embellishment, to Grandma. She was less sympathetic than I had hoped. I remember her laughing heartily. Everyone laughed. I guess it must have been funny. Paperboy. After a year of collecting eggs and killing chickens, my brother and I were whooshed out of the country and reunited with our mother and sister at 7308 Owens Mouth Avenue in Canoga Park, a house in need of either a retrofit or a wrecking ball. On the plus side, it was big. To offset the cost of leasing the whole place, my mother rented two small cottages in the backyard and two rooms inside the house to strangers. The renters were middle-aged single men on the low ebb of their luck. They all used one toilet in the back of the house, but had to find other means to shower. We never knew and never asked. However, one man insisted, as part of his rental agreement, to be allowed to take a bath once a day in the only bathroom in the house. Every day, at 3 p.m., We were required to unlock the access door to the bathroom from the back hallway to allow Mr. Clean to come in and bathe, shave, or do whatever he chose to do in there for an